Accession number 10601, rule 3.
Mr. Cottier, Reel 3. I'd just like to ask you about about leave. How frequently did you get leave at the weekends?
Well, after the first month, you more or less got every weekend after the first month. I say every weekend, that's from 12 o'clock midday Saturday to 12 o'clock Sunday. Of course, you got this leave provided you weren't required for church prayer on Sunday, or you weren't required for fatigues, spud bashing. It was left to the discretion of the squad sergeant.
When you got leave, did you always go home at that point?
Yes, yes. It was only a short run from Marlborough Crescent, an hour in a bus to Ledgate, just a short run. And I used to generally leave about 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, get back in good time, because I didn't like the idea of being marked absent. Because if you were a minute late, you were on the charge.
Did that ever happen to you?
Not to me. It did happen, lots of chaps. But not to me, because I always make sure I got in good time.
You said earlier on in the interview that getting out an evening pass was difficult because you finished very late and it was difficult to get out anyway because you had to pass a sort of inspection. Did you ever go out, though, in the evenings into Newcastle?
Very rare. Very rare. Occasionally, I used to go along to Benwell, down the road. I had an aunt living there. And occasionally, I would go there, but my cousins was away in the forces and there wasn't much in the way of entertainment there, you know. I just paid them a social visit. That was in the evenings. But weekends, I went home.
You also mentioned boxing in passing earlier on. Was that a sport that occupied you very much at Fenham?
Well, I was never much interested in boxing. Not at Fenham, as such. We did have into squad boxing, but not on a very
big scale, because in the first place they didn't have much time for it. You know, you're too busy training for the train program. But later on, when I joined the battalion, I took part in boxing, into company, and I got a medal, as a matter of fact, for the best loser. The gymnasium was rigged up. And of course, the officer was there in the evening dress with the wives, ringside seats. And I was boxing this chap who was in the horse transport. We did have four or five horses. It walked in at the time, Colonel's horse and Adjutant's horse. And this chap was a groom. And he's slightly bigger than me, heavier. And he gave me a real hiding, I remember. I could see the white, the red spots of blood on the white canvas. And from what I gather, my colleagues were shouting for me to stop, you know, lie down sort of thing. I didn't hear them. I was getting such a hiding. It's only a 3-round contest, 2-minute round, amateur, you know. And of course, after the contest was finished, names was called out to receive the trophies, tankards, you know. And behold, my name was called out. And I was dazed. And when I stepped up to the ring, I got this medal for being the best loser of all things. And that was the beginning, the end for me, for boxing. And I never, of course, the war came on. So there was no more scope for it, really.
Whilst at Fenham, was there any other sports that were organised for the men?
No. No. There was just a normal PT in the gymnasium as per schedule and the cross country. And I say, there was a little bit into squad boxing, but not much. It wasn't supported a great deal.
One last thing. You mentioned this silver cane that you won on three occasions at Fenham. Did that present any difficulties, perhaps, with your relationships with the other privates in the squad, the fact that you had this cane?
No, I think this was accepted right from the very beginning. At night time, when we had the shiny parade, as I previously mentioned, I would spend a lot of time polishing my bayonet scabbard, my boots, what have you. And other chaps would come along and rather amazed and wondered how I got my boots so shiny, how I got my bayonet scabbard so shiny. Well, I don't really know. It was just, there's no secret to it. Just spit and polish, patience. And I think from then on, they realised that it was obvious that I would get the silver cane, which had been so much talked about. And I got no harassment from them or skit or nothing. As a matter of fact, it was accepted.
Did it in any way give you any sort of privileges? Was there any actual privilege that went along with having the cane, apart from carrying it at all?
Only when I went out at the weekends on leave pass. You had to go before the regimental police at the gate, and you had to satisfy them that you were smart and clean. And when they noticed that I had the silver cane because I had a silver band on, pretty obvious, they just should not then say, okay, you know. And I think that did me a bit of good, you know, an advantage.
You mentioned when we were talking previously that you were actually a blood donor as well there. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, yes. There was one occasion when the squad sergeant formed his squad up on the barrack square, and he selected six men, and I was one of the six. And there was a 1,500-weight truck standing nearby, and he told us to climb on the truck, and that was the first time I'd been in an army vehicle. And he told us that we're going down to the RVI, be blood tested. There's a captain from the Royal Army Medical Corps requiring a blood transfusion. And we had a blood test, they pricked our ears and took a blood slide. And I think there was three of us, myself and a chap called Sopwith, I forget the other chap's name, selected. And we were kept back for 3 or 4 hours. Then I was led into this room and asked to lie on the bed on top of the clothing, the blanket, while this doctor lay underneath. And they put a needle into my vein and one into the doctor's vein on a Y system with a sort of a tap. And they extracted the blood from me, changed the tap and pushed the blood into him. And that was the form of blood transfusion in those days.
Did it have any effect upon you?
Oh, no, no whatsoever. You just got... Well, I think we walked back. We walked back to the from the RVI, if I remember correctly. We walked back. And this was the advice of the doctor, that we walked back from the RVI to Fenham Barracks. But it had no effect on me whatsoever. I didn't feel any effects of it. And we didn't get any pat on the back or anything like that, or extra leave, nothing like that. Just a... And that was the one only time I ever gave blood. That was 1938.
Okay. At the end of your training, was there any sort of formalities that the Ains squad went through before you were sent off to the next barracks, the next part of your training?
No. Do you mean when we left Fenham to go to Woking? No, there was no party. You mean no parties, nothing like that. There was no shake hands or farewells. It was just another day. You just got up before war, and that we knew a week beforehand what day we were going to Woking. We were looking forward to it because it was a big thing for a recruit to graduate and join his parent battalion. It's a great thing.
You know, and what was your parent battalion?
The 2nd Battalion, the 08th Infantry. And it was just like a kid going on a summer school trip. But there was no sort of booze up in the mess or the canteen or shaking hands. You just went on parade next morning, you marched down to the station, you got on the train. That's all there was to it.
Okay, can you take me now to Woking? What happened there?
Well, we arrived in the Baddock Square, Woking, and Colonel Yates was present. He was Colonel of the battalion then. Of course, the adjutant, the RSM, Goddard. And had a sort of a preliminary inspection. Of course, we were somewhat dishevelled, travelling all the way from Newcastle and marching from Woking up to the barracks. It wasn't expected us to be like guardsmen at that stage, you know, it was just a sort of a reception committee. And we split up, somebody to a company, and I went to A company. And there's already chaps in the barrack room, like, there's, I think there were six of us went to A company, chaps in the barrack room. And my sergeant major was Sergeant Major Green, Tubby Green. Little chap he was. And I spent about 3 days, I think, with the company, not doing much in the way of parades or duties. I suppose it was to find out what we're best suited to, because when you go to a battalion like that, lots of men get what you call employed. You see? It's like there's batmen, cooks, storekeepers. And I suppose this 2 or 3 days would be to see what I was best suited for. And so happens, if you're not suited for anything, then you're just one of the lads, you know, your fatigue party, you know, general duties. If you're not selected for any particular employment.
You're saying there was a sort of selection. Was there any formal process of selection?
No. No, I suppose that went from records, which is... came down with you from Fedham, on your appearance in general, I suppose. But they didn't come and ask you, you know, what are you good at, or what have you been in civil life, or... Well, they didn't with me, they just picked on me, you know, out of the blue.
Can you describe what happened to you?
I've been there about 3 days, and this particular morning, I was in the barrack room, and the provost sergeant walked in. John Henry Maguire, his name was. And of course, we knew all about him in the first place because we'd been forewarned. And all provost sergeants are pigs, in any case.
What did you be forewarned about Maguire?
Well, because he's notorious, you know. Least bit thing, you went in the guard room, you know. Old soldiers have told us about him. Old soldiers.
These are the men who were in your company who told you that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Keep wide of them, sort of thing. And of course we had dealings with the regimental police at Fenham, but not on the same scale as a battalion. And then he walked, this provost sergeant. I thought, well, what have I done? He was followed by the sergeant major, Green, Tubby Green. And they just told me to pack me kit. He, of course, in them days didn't ask questions, he weren't allowed to. Just did you just told him. So I packed my kit, and I was marched across to the guard room. I thought, well, I'm going the right direction for the guard room, you know. And when I got across the guard room, Maguire, provost sergeant, said, well, this is your bed. Make your bed up. Which was a general slogan. And when I looked around, I saw there was another regiment of police sitting on the beds, you know. And I realised then I'd been assigned to the regiment of police. I'd been told, I just guessed.
Now, the regimental police, you've already established, were not particularly popular people. What did you feel about the fact that you were now part of that body of men in the DLI?
Well, I felt proud. Because in the first place, there were men who were smart, efficient. They were hand-picked. And I thought, well... I'm getting into a category, at least. I'm in a slot. I belong to something. Although they didn't have a very good name. But that was part of the job. That went with the job. You see? I knew that. But that didn't worry me. I was in a slot. I'd been selected. I was somebody. I wasn't just a soldier. And of course, I had my second class certificate of education. And
what significance is that in this context of being a regimental policeman?
Well, to be a regimental policeman, you have to have your second class certificate of education. You don't have to have it in any course, but except for being a sergeant. If you had any ideas of becoming a sergeant, then you had to qualify and have your second class certificate of education. Your third class would take you as far as corporal. But to be a sergeant, you had to have your second. And to be a regimental policeman, you had to have your second. So that in itself was a status, you see. And of course, I was just shown the rudiments of regimental police routine.
Can you explain what they were?
Well, you stood at the gate for a start, and you represented the battalion. In other words, you were a window dressing. You had to dress and look the part, you see. You were like a shop window fitting, and you had to check everyone going in and coming out of the barracks to see that they were properly dressed, and even in civilians, a dress uniform or service dress. It was your job to see that they were properly dressed, and you record it in a book that Private Smith, wearing dress uniform, left at 7:30. You had to record it in the book. People coming in, you had to take an account of people coming in, check their identities. That was one part. Another part of the job was to supervise defaulters. When a man committed an offence, he was awarded so many days CB, confined to barracks, defaulters. And on the bugler sounding defaulters, a defaulter had to answer to the guardroom. He fell in, he was a defaulter. And it was a regimental policeman's job to take him to task, usually scrubbing steps, scrubbing floors, and he supervised that. You also had men serving detention in cells. You had to see that the man was fed, proper meal times, his cell was kept clean, and that he was taken to task, carrying out various things like polishing buckets and things like that, you know, unpleasant tasks.
Did you yourself choose the tasks, or was there somebody wrote your tasks to do?
By the provost sergeant. It was assigned by the task, was assigned by the provost sergeant. You've got six men, go and scrub the dining hall out. You had six men with buckets, and you just see that they did it, you see, and kept them in order. Then, of course, you had heath fire patrols. Of course, to do this, the regimental police had to be able to ride a motorcycle, and we should travel around Bisley, Bagshot, Knaphill, Purbright, where all the heather in the moorland was, looking for heath fires. And if you saw a heath fire, you had to report it.
Who did you report it to?
Well, if you saw a heath fire in the distance, you estimated the map reference on a map, and you went to the nearest telephone box, and you phoned the duty battalion that week. It could be the DLI, 2nd Battalion, it could be the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, it could be the Berkshires, it could be the Guards, but you knew that week. And you phoned the officer, duty officer, in that battalion, and told him there was every indication to the heath fire, it map reference such and such. Then, of course, he alerted his battalion, and they went out as a mobile unit with beaters and beat the fire out, you see. Now, that was another job for the regimental police.
Those different regimental battalions you referred to there, they weren't all stationed at Woking, were they?
No, they were nearby, Purbright, Knaphill, Brookwood. They were maybe 3 or 4 mile, 5 mile radius. They were in the brigade. You see, they were now a brigade scattered about.
How often would you do something like heath fire patrols?
Well, each battalion did it for a week, and you can estimate there's about 5 battalions, maybe more with the guards, maybe once every two months.
I see. So the regimental police for each battalion would take turns.
Yes, regimental police.
And what about gate duties? Was that is that something you did every day?
You did every day. You did probably about 2 hours on gate duties. Then you also had an exchange in the police post. There's a man who said the police post, man in the exchange, incoming calls, outgoing calls, only a small exchange. He manned that, you see, and taking any messages. I mean, I remember taking one message for Major Seabag Monteviori. Well, this Seabag Monteviori was a very wealthy man. And there was one morning I got a call about 4 o'clock that his brother had died. Well, this Major, Seabag Monteviori, lived in the officer's quarters, which maybe 100 yards away. And I locked up the police post because I was on night duty. Went up to his house. You can imagine what a private soldier felt like. 4 o'clock in the morning, ringing the bell at 4 o'clock in the morning on a major's house. What reception I was going to get. It wasn't very pleasant to tell him that his brother had died. Anyhow, I remember this major, Seabag Monteviori, coming down, opened the door. He had like a sort of smoke jacket on and a helmet, a hat, a sleeping hat with a pom-pom. First time I'd ever seen one. Yes, what is it? I said, I've got a telegram here, sir. It's sad news. Your brother's passed away. Huh. As if I didn't have enough trouble with my own money. And that was the very words he used.
Are you shocked by that?
Yes, because I was fit to tell him that his brother died, but he wasn't concerned about that. He was concerned about having to take responsibility of his money. He says, as though I haven't got enough trouble with my own money. And that was it. And that was just one thing which I experienced when I was on telephone exchange. Then we had a captain quartermaster, Ozzie Pearson. He was a born gambler. And every now and then, during the daytime, of course, ringing up his bookie, placing bets. And that exchange was used more for him, placing his bets, than it was for anything else. Ozzie Pearson, he was ex-RSM, come captain quartermaster, you know, and he was a character throughout the battalion.
Can you recall any other duties you had over and above the ones you've already mentioned?
We did like barrack patrol on a Sunday and Saturday and in the evenings, walking through barrack rooms, catching men playing cards, gambling, which wasn't permitted. You weren't allowed to play, you weren't allowed to gamble. And you'd often come to a school, a dozen of men sitting around a table playing cards, and they were so engrossed in playing the cards, they never saw you come through the door. You see? Well, all he said was, right, leave the money. And you just pick the money up, you pick the cards up, confiscated them as additions, and they were brought before the commanding officer next day. And gambling, you see. You had control the queues in the canteens. You had to visit the canteen every hour, looking for drunks, if there was any. You put them inside. Watching for band boys. They had to be out the canteen by 9 o'clock at night, and they weren't allowed any beer.
When you say bad boys, band boys.
You see, they had to be out the canteen by 9 o'clock at night. And they weren't allowed to drink beer, just drink tea and cake. Then, of course, there was, like, the Marie Quarter Patrol, going on the Marie Quarters, because they were out of bounds to troops, not married. Because at times you did get troops wandering into Marie Quarters.
How would you know whether someone had a legitimate business to be there or not?
Oh, well, we knew them, because at Woking, there was very few privates, none that I know of, in Marie Quarters. There's only a couple of corporals. Most of them were sergeants and sergeant majors. And you knew them very well, you know, you knew the difference. And if you did, you could always stop and ask them to prove the... there was genuine cases where a private maybe had to go to a sergeant major's house for some particular reason, and he's making his return journey back to the barracks. Things like that, you see. Well, if he says, oh, I'm visiting Sergeant Major so-and-so, well, that was fair enough, because they wouldn't pull a fasten on, they wouldn't dare pull a fasten on you. They wouldn't dare.
Were these houses provided by the army?
Oh, yes.
Would the army provide married quarters for a private and his wife?
I suppose they would. The thing is, in them days, most privates were young, in the 18s. And the older soldiers of that particular period were what you call, I would say, settled in life. They didn't want to get married. They thought too much about the beer. You know, we did have older men, but they were in a groove. They had no desires for marriage. They thought more about the canteen and getting drunk, you know. And I don't recall any privates walking being married.
Okay, thank you. Can you think of any other patrols that you had to do? Did you have to go outside of the barracks at all? Was that part of your job?
No, not normally. Not normally. The only time we went outside of the barracks is if we had a man in close arrest on a civilian charge, and he had to be escorted to court, and we went with a defending officer. Now, that's another thing we used to do as well, court-martials. I never did any court-martials in peacetime, but I did during the war. Escort to court-martials, you see. But as for walking, there's only one occasion I had to attend court with a chap who was on a civilian charge. And that's the only time we went outside the barracks in the form of authority, you know.
Can you tell me about that particular incident?
Well, just this lad, he had broke into a... He got involved with a young girl, and this girl was more or less demanding jewellery and that. He couldn't... His army pay just wasn't it. And he broke into a house to get money to keep his favours with this girl. That was all. And, of course, that was a civilian charge. And, of course, we detained... we detained him in our barracks on remand to appear in court. Normally a civilian would have been remanded, you see. But being a soldier, right from the very beginning, we detained him. We didn't want him absconding. It's because our responsibility. And that's the only time I was outside the barracks.
So he's kept in barracks and then taken to the civil court?
Civil court. Then the officer goes with him to give off his character, you see. I forget the outcome of it. I don't know what he got, no. There was one occasion when we had a soldier doing detention, a fella called Anderson, from my squad at Fenham Barracks. When he arrived in Woking, for some particular reason, he didn't want a soldier. He got into trouble with his sergeant, his sergeant major, and eventually he ended up by getting detention at Woking.